Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with historian Carolyn Morrow Long, author of Madame LaLaurie, Mistress of the Haunted House, and poet Bill Lavender, whose new memoir in verse is called Memory Wing. Carolyn Morrow Long writes about some of the things I find most interesting. She's the author of Spiritual Merchants, Religion, Magic, and Commerce, and A New Orleans Voodoo Priestess, The Legend and Reality of Marie Laveau. Her new book tackles one of the darkest and most mysterious figures in New Orleans history, Madame LaLaurie, Mistress of the Haunted House. Carolyn, it's such a pleasure to have you at The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Now, you've been coming to New Orleans since 1978, and that's just
right.
Continued with your interest in our history. And retirement from the museum has freed you to write your own books. So what made you want to write about this character?
I like to investigate people that are legendary in New Orleans. And, you know, at first I got interested in Marie Laveau, and actually it was when I was doing the work on Marie and going through the indexes of the notarial archives and the conveyance office. You know, I'm in the LAs and I was finding Laveau and I was finding LaLaurie, and I thought, boy, there's a lot of material on her. I think this is going to have to be my next project.
So Madame LaLaurie is infamous for one terrible event, the fire at her house on April 10th, 1834. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, on that day, a fire broke out in the kitchen, which was in the attached service wing. A lot of people now think that it actually happened in the house, but remember that in the 19th century, the kitchen was never in the residence. It was in either a detached or an attached service building, and the slave quarters were up above it. And so some people think that the cook started the fire. There's actually some evidence for that in the newspaper reports, where one article does say that she started it on purpose. But remember that people already knew that Madame LaLaurie had been mistreating her slaves. That it was known as early as 1828. People had complained to the authorities about it. She had been called before the criminal court. And so when the fire broke out and people began to gather around, they knew that there were slaves imprisoned up above the kitchen. And fortunately, Judge Canonge lived right across the street, and he was one of the first people there. And he, you know, demanded to be let in to rescue the slaves, was rebuffed by both of the LaLauries, ordered that the doors be broken down, and a group of volunteers went in, and then the newspaper reports describe what they found, quote, seven wretched Negroes, loaded with chains and, you know, emaciated and starved and beaten and just in terrible, terrible condition. And they were carried out. And everybody saw them. They were taken to the mayor's office at the Cabildo. More people saw them. The newspapers said that 2,000 people came by and saw them. So it's not like they just heard about it. They saw them. And that's why the people became so angry and surrounded the house. And then when she escaped without punishment, they were furious and they attacked the house and just about tore it down.
And she escaped fairly easily and quickly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that fascinated me about your book was to see how well-connected she was to prominent people of the period. I mean, some of the great names in Louisiana history are in this book.
Well, through her first and second husbands, her third husband, Dr. LaLaurie, was pretty much of a nobody. But she was from a very wealthy, large, and powerful family. And that's probably how she wiggled out of the earlier charges and why the sheriff didn't come to arrest her on the day of the fire.
So tell me about some of her other relatives.
One of her cousins was the mayor of New Orleans, Augustine McCarty. Her parents owned a big plantation out in the Bywater. Another uncle owned a big plantation up in Carrollton. Another relative had a plantation in St. Bernard Parish, right where the Chalmette Battlefield is now. Uh-huh. And then many of her male relatives had long-term liaisons with free women of color and produced many children. So there were white McCartys and colored McCartys.
A big, complicated Louisiana family with all that that implies. This idea of the haunted house at the heart of the French Quarter, in a way, has even become fodder for websites, for graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story that's lived on in other books as well.
Oh, yes. Barbara Hambly, especially.
And Barbara is, of course, a wonderful writer of
Louisiana historical fiction. I wish that Barbara would turn this into a novel. I've been in touch with her, and in fact, I sent her a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't write fiction. I can't make stuff up. But Barbara is such a wonderful writer, and she could take the facts of this story and turn it into a really good novel.
Now, the epilogue of this book I find especially fascinating because you go through and you document the facts of Madame LaLaurie's life so thoroughly and so completely, and then you return to the house with three psychics. So describe that.
Well, when I realized that the 175th anniversary of the fire was going to fall on Good Friday, and that I was going to be here, I thought, there's a story in this. So fortunately, I'm friends with a lot of psychics. So we met on the sidewalk in the morning about the time that they would have been carrying the slaves out. And Mary, who is also a voodoo priestess, performed a ceremony to open the way for the spirits. And, you know, the traffic's going by and the tour groups are going by, but we were just trying to concentrate on what we were doing. And then we all just kept quiet, and the three women either sat there on the sidewalk or walked around the house a little bit, and they all wrote down their impressions. We were there for 45 minutes or an hour. Then we went over to Croissant d'Or and talked and drank coffee and ate pastries and compared notes. Now, if they had come up with impressions from slaves that I could readily identify, because I do know who all of the slaves were. That was, I think, the most important part of my research.
Right.
I know their names, their ages, their colors, the jobs they performed. So if they had said names that I recognized or described characteristics that I recognized, I would have really freaked out. But they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
They described some very interesting things, and then I tried to match that up with what I knew about the slaves who had lived there. And they sort of matched up, but not exactly. So it was a wonderful experience, but it wasn't as definitive as I would have liked it to be.
The other thing you've done that I find so interesting and so lovely is that you painted a portrait of her. It's very beautiful, and just as you did for your Marie Laveau book. It's almost as if these stories have freed you up to become the artist as well.
Well, I actually started out as an artist. My whole college background is in studio art. I almost have a Master of Fine Arts, but because of personal circumstances, I didn't graduate. But, you know, all my life I thought of myself as an artist. I was an artist, an art teacher, and then, you know, the work I did at the Smithsonian was related to my artistic skills. And then I started writing.
Ah.
So, you know, people who knew me as an artist are thinking, what are you doing writing?
Mm-hmm.
And people who know me as a writer think, well, you couldn't do the cover to your book. writers don't do that.
That's every writer's dream, you know.
But, hey, I can do both. There is an existing portrait of Madame LaLaurie, so I use that. But the portrait of her makes her look quite pleasant and rather sweet. So I thought, well, I can't make her look like that. I think that was probably painted when she was much younger. So I needed to make her look older and mean. And I wanted her to look completely detached from what was going on. The portrait of her is a drawing, And then the flames behind her head are a collage made with marbled paper. And so I wanted her to look like, what's all the fuss about? What's this got to do with me?
Well, that would certainly work. Oh, Carolyn, it's such a pleasure to talk with you. I always look forward to your books. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
You can meet Carolyn Long tonight, March 6th at 7 p.m. at the Alvar Library, and Wednesday, March 7th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet Bill Lavender is the managing editor of the University of New Orleans Press and director of the Low Residency Creative Writing Program here at the University of New Orleans, where he's also an adjunct assistant professor of English. We're here to talk about his new book, a memoir in poetry called Memory Wing. Welcome back to the Reading Live, Bill.
Hi, Susan. Thanks.
You're prolific. You're so prolific. This is such an amazing book. I loved it. How did you think of doing a memoir in the form of a long, wonderful poem?
I just wanted to experiment with the realm of memory, and I'm used to writing in lines, and so that was the way I decided to do it. And after a few pages, I decided I liked the form, and 290 pages later, there it is.
Right. It's amazing. But you read it with this fascination. It's so vivid and lively.
Well, one of the things I wanted to do was to try and capture not just the memories, but the idiom of the memory. So it's very vernacular, and I tried to write as I spoke in those days and in these days, and, you know, not with the normal filtering that usually occurs when you write a memory.
Right. And Memory Wing is such a lovely title. I love that image of the extended wing on the title page. And this memoir begins literally in a memory wing. Would you tell us about that?
Well, the term memory wing is used in some places to designate the Alzheimer's area of a hospital or a home. And so there was that meaning, and then the notion of the wing, which actually comes from Baudelaire, who felt the wind of the wing of madness at one time. And so there were those two things working together, and Alzheimer's is a thing that sort of haunts the poem. It begins on that note with my mother. Just this fear that we all have, I would imagine, of losing our memories.
And literally losing our words.
Yeah.
I love that line you have that Alzheimer's is linguistic.
Uh-huh.
The first part of this memoir is dedicated to your mother, the second to your father, who had been dead a long time by the time of the writing, and the third to your sons. Was this structure apparent to you from the very beginning?
Very early on, I decided on the structure, yes. Mm-hmm. It's not so much a dedication as a selected interlocutor. Bakhtin says that always when we're writing, we are basically talking to ghosts.
Right.
And so I just decided that I would choose my ghosts carefully and decide who I was going to be speaking to in each section. So in the first section, I'm speaking to my mother on her deathbed. In the second section, to my father in the underworld. And in the third section, speaking to my sons from the underworld. That one is set slightly in the future.
And a lot of what you're writing about here are the reversals that come with age. I mean, you say to your mother, you know, that you're reading to her instead of her reading to you.
Mm-hmm.
You say to your sons that you will be their memory. It's that lovely kind of way time shifts everything for all of us.
Yeah, and how in age we enter a kind of second childhood, as is often said, and that was something that occurred to me while I was reading to my mother.
So you talk about a lot of things in this book. You talk about growing up in Arkansas. You talk about your early life as a writer. You talk about being a contractor. I never knew that about you.
Yeah, 20 years.
I was just in the business. It's
just
incredible. What was the hardest thing for you to write about?
Sex.
Really?
Well, there were actually a number of things that were difficult to write about, not really just sex, but just sort of personal relationships. I mean, a lot of the people that I write about are, you know, still alive.
Still
and
here.
The onset of social media, suddenly I'm back in contact with a lot of people who are mm-hmm. in this book who I haven't thought about in, you know, 30 or 40 years. So that was very strange. But the rule or the resolution I made for myself when I was writing the book was that I was going to use real names.
Right.
And if I said anything, it was going to be completely honest. And it's a very difficult rule to adhere to. And I just had to pretend while I was writing it that no one was ever going to read it. That's pretty much how I managed to do that.
So it can keep you out of one kind of trouble, but it could get you into another kind of trouble altogether.
Oh, it's already gotten me into trouble.
I can imagine. How did you know in the first place that the time was right for you to do this book, that you had reached the age where you had this before you?
I don't know. It just felt right. I just sort of started doing it, and there it went. My book before this one, Transfixion, was a very mm-hmm. different book. It's very formal, very literary, very just a very different kind of experience. And the writing of it was a very different kind of experience. And to write in this very prosy, loose form was kind of liberating, and it felt uh-huh. very good. So in the beginning, it was just sort of to do something different than I had been doing. But then gradually the thing acquired a life of its own and sort of took itself away from me.
As all the best books do, don't you think? When you finished it, what did you find it had done for you?
There are some things I learned from it, for sure. And one of them is that you can never say it all. And, I mean, it's not a huge book. It's not the size of Ulysses, okay? But it's a pretty good-sized book. It's the longest book I've written to date, and it doesn't really even scratch the surface. I mean, there's so much that could go on. I mean, there are five more books like that that I could write, and actually about the same time periods. So that was revelatory, that
right.
maybe there really is no such thing as a memoir. You know, it's very difficult to encompass everything.
So read a little bit for us, would you?
Okay, this is from the very beginning, and it's a bit of an excerpt, just kind of give an idea of some of the themes and the tone. I'm talking to my mother here right at the beginning. She's facing the wall, talking to her dead mother, mumbling at the window, snow rising up outside, wind stirring the drifts. "Is that you?" she says, and I say, "Yes, it's me." And she says, "Mama was just here in the foyer. Maybe you saw her. And Bill is coming later, I think. Can you stay a while?" "When was the last time you saw him? Was it Christmas? Has it been that long?" And I say, "I think it's been at least that long." And Mama says, "She's sorry." She apologizes. "It wasn't her Mama," she says, "but my Aunt Julia, who'd been there before I came in. Her sister Julia, who's only been dead 20 years instead of 60, Mama, the youngest of 10, and the last living, Julia and Brian and Philip and Ralph and Garland and Maud and Willie and Berta and baby Anna, all gone to Mount Comfort now. Garland, the most recent, doddering and vehement with Alzheimer's, insulting those who slaved for him, paranoid and bitter, loved in memory only. The interminable last year, making everyone miserable, his wife and daughter crying in their pillows. But even that year that seemed it would never end is over now, and Garland lies with his wife and brothers and sisters and mother and father and uncles and aunts and grandfathers and grandmothers and cousins and friends and enemies, and people who pretended to be friends but were really enemies, and people he thought were enemies but were really friends. Lies with them all the same in the frozen earth, under the falling snow, in the cemetery at Mount Comfort, just over the hill there, outside the window of the memory wing, where my mother lies talking to them, talking to the dead. And I say, yes, I figured it was Julia. I knew that was who you meant.
I love that. It's an exquisite book, Bill. It really is.
Well, thank you.
And I love it that Julia, too, was a poet.
Aunt Julia was a poet.
And you found that little book.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking with Bill Lavender about his fascinating memoir, Memory Wing. You can meet Bill Lavender at Octavia Books March 8th at 6 p.m. or at McKeon's Books and Difficult Music March 9th at 7:30. Thanks. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Carolyn Morrow Long, signs Madame Lalaurie, Mistress of the Haunted House, Wednesday, March 7th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Bill Lavender, signs his memoir in verse, Memory Wing, Thursday, March 8th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Constance Adler signs My Bayou, New Orleans Through the Eyes of a Lover, Thursday, March 8th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Bayou St. John. John Klinkman signs New in New Orleans Architecture, Thursday, March 8th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Kit Wall signs New Orleans Classic Brunches, Saturday, March 10th from 1 to 3 at Maple Street Bookshop Uptown. Robert Jeanfro signs The Story Behind the Stone, Saturday, March 10th from 3 to 5 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Designer Suzanne Perron signs Designing in Ivory and White, Saturday, March 10th from noon to 2 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Candace Proctor, who writes as C.S. Harris, signs When Maidens Mourn, Saturday, March 10th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Russell Greenan's It Happened in Boston, Saturday, March 10th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. Robert Cannigale signs his new book, On an Irish Island, Wednesday, March 14th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. And coming up later this month, Walter Isaacson discusses and signs Steve Jobs and talks about New Orleans libraries, Thursday, March 15th at 12:30 p.m. at the Main Library, 219 Loyola Avenue. And get set for the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 21st through 25th at the Hotel Monteleon. For more information, TennesseeWilliams.net. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org or email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.